All right, everybody, and welcome to Philosophy Hot Topics. All right, we're going to...
It's Saturday.
But we're going to do a twist in our philosophy series. It's been a while since Brett and I recorded something together. And I think we wanted to try something a little bit new. So there are often a number of kind of hot topics out there that people in the industry are talking about. There's a few out there now that I'm hearing and just wanted to kind of bring up some of those topics and talk about those here with you guys and with Brett. And in ahead of that, one of the things that I did is on LinkedIn, I posted a poll about various hot topics that I'm hearing about ahead of a dinner I had in LA with a bunch of game industry people. And then I also talked to them about various issues that are concerning them. And so we can go over some of what these potential hot topics are. And in the poll, I was only able to list four, but the four that I did list was one, impact of global recession. Two, do politics belong in a company or not? Three, the dramatic fall of UA in terms of performance. And then four, how to do product validation. And so based on that poll, looks like the topic that most people thought was the hottest topic right now, and maybe also because MAU was a recent event, is the dramatic fall of UA, followed by, at 43%, followed by how to do product validation at 27%, impact of global recession at 25%, and then do politics belong in a company at only 6%. So maybe we could talk about those things in order. And there were a few other things that I'm just hearing of that we can talk about as well. And Brett, if you have anything else you want to that you're hearing about, we can talk about those. But before we dive in, any thoughts on that, Brett?
Well, it just brings me back to my link testing days, and I wonder if the word dramatic had anything to do with it, because that's the first word of the one. Whereas how to, when I did a link test, I found that asking a question was not as effective as a statement. Mm-hmm.
So it could be biased.
There could be bias in the framing of your questions here. Impact of global recession, some hot words there. Although do politics. Yeah. So the two ones that were statements did better than sort of the questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, given that, it may be biased, but maybe we could actually dive into those in that order and then bring up any other topics. But starting with this UA apocalypse. And so just to set the context for people, ever since like GDC, I've been increasingly hearing from game studios that since about May of last year, formerly profitable UA campaigns have gone negative or are barely breaking even. But certainly all that stuff at lower scale. And so what are the implications of that? And some of these companies have also stated that they previously had offers for acquisition. But now that all their UA campaigns are going lower, turning negative, they really kind of regret having turned down some of those acquisitions offers. And they're actually wondering about going back and trying to get acquired, but at a lower valuation now. Also though, in response to my LinkedIn post, there was-
Please acquire us.
We changed our minds.
No, wait.
One comment I got on LinkedIn was from, for those that don't know, Warren Woodward, the CEO of Uptick, a really great user acquisition consulting agency. But one of the things that he wrote, and let me actually read it for you guys. One thing I believe we're seeing is a market wisening up to unprofitable financial engineering that was driven by UA in past years. Many companies were acquired based on fake growth stories due to lack of deep understanding of UA by the acquiring party. I think the dirty secret in our industry was that a large percentage of growth stories were knowingly unprofitable and unsustainable, and now larger entities are realizing they didn't buy what they thought they bought. I think part of that is true too. But I think that where... I may differ from Warren, and I'm actually getting a podcast together with Warren to dive deep on this later, probably sometime next month. But I do think that with IDFA deprecation, that the fundamental UA landscape has also gotten more difficult. I do think that Warren for, you know, maybe he's seeing better performance based upon his games. And there's also like the potential implication that depending on the type of game that you have, the more hyper casual you are, for example, it might be easier. I mean, I don't know. But what I am hearing from a number of companies and at that gaming dinner I went to and with some other folks I spoke to in LA, it does seem that the overall landscape for user acquisition has gotten meaningfully more challenging. And so the implication of that would be lower volume, because when ROAS comes down, you have to scale down your user acquisition campaigns, meaning lower volume, meaning lower revenue, and lower margins, even at the same volume. So essentially, higher difficulty in being able to achieve project profitability. But I don't know, there are some other folks who have pushed back and said, well, that, you know, SCAD v4 and iOS 16 is going to have three postbacks. There's going to be meaningful improvement to UA performance with the next iteration of SCAD, which is the attribution methodology that Apple has provided for game developers. But I don't see, I mean, I think it could be better. I just don't see it being able to return us back to the space where we were before, to be able to drive, you know, meaningfully better profitable ROAS for your game, especially the more mid-core or hardcore, the longer your ARPU curve where early signals won't matter. But anyway, any thoughts on that, Brett?
Yeah, a couple thoughts. I think the first one is that this was somewhat inevitable. I mean, I don't like doing this, but I because I probably should pull up when I was saying it to make sure, but I have been saying this for a while that if you think about the UA market, it really well represents the perfect market, right? The platforms have so much data on both sides of the market, right? That it's pretty well designed to be a perfect market eventually, right? A perfect market being that there really is no profit. And so I kind of feel like in some ways this was inevitable because you just have the platforms gathering more and more information. You have the more and more, the developers spending more and more, and sort of like you're going to get there. Now, what does that mean for a couple things? To counter that, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but if we do go into a recession, I think that will open things up for gaming because gaming generally is more or less recession proof. In fact, probably inversely correlated to recession, meaning that it may do better in the recession as people turn to cheaper forms of entertainment. There's more capital pumped into the ecosystem from government, just in general. So that could make it so that the market opens up more, and because you're going to have companies, a lot of the other tech companies that are outside of gaming drop off on their UA spend, right? So it's less competitive and it'll be better. That said, that's just kind of prolonging, again, the inevitable when the recession ends. Hopefully it ends at some point if there is a recession, which most people think there's going to be, then you're still going to have this perfect market end up happening. So what does that kind of mean for games? The other thing I'll say, okay, before I get to that, the other thing I'll say is, at least from my standpoint, the real opportunity then is in the monetization of players, right? And I think you're going to basically, that's not as progressing probably as fast enough as a decline in UA. But I think that's really where the opportunity is going to lie, right? Most people in America have some form of smartphone. Most people in America have played some form of game. And then on that spectrum, you have older people who have played less, you know, saying, well, why do you, or spending less in some ways, in some markets, obviously saying, well, this game's like, why is this? And you have the younger group kind of coming up, living in a world where games and spending money on games is completely normal, right? There is no world without that, right? And so that is going to increase the potential value that you can generate from just users in general. But that's taking a longer time frame than the cost of acquisition, right? So that's why you're seeing like this unprofitable UA. And then the last, okay, yeah, if you want to jump in, but the last, yeah, you go.
Yeah, I was just about to say that there's like a few different things that I think about based upon some of the comments that you're making. But I think the part about competition in, for example, a maturing industry where, you know, the theoretically you, once you, you know, in any market, you will then have new competitors that then compete away margin in those businesses, right? But I would say one thing that's kind of interesting to think about is how the environment kind of shapes the type of competitors that can compete in a space. And so there's a couple of ways that I think about this. The first side is that when we think about the existing players in the market under an IDFA scenario in which you're able to, you know, pretty well characterize players, target players of high monetization, which we no longer have, but that especially for super long ARPU games, the incumbents can actually create a bigger moat because they have data and they have certainty or greater certainty around what ARPU profiles look like. And they have more certainty around the ability to spend and create this user acquisition moat against competition. So to some degree, you could say that IDFA deprecation will help competition, help the ability for new players to come into a market and to compete away margin or profits in, you know, in a specific game genre, for example. So I think that's one thing. I think the second thing is when we think about the dynamics of the game development ecosystem, one thing that we can think about when it comes to competition and the market is that because of the macroeconomic environment, you know, zero interest rate kind of environment, and the impact of which was to really drive up in, you know, the sort of M&A wave that we've had prior to COVID for the past 5-6 years. And then that dynamic has created a different ecosystem of the kinds of companies that are standalone entities competing as smaller insurgents versus the larger incumbents, which are now basically like companies that have acquired a bunch of other entities, right? And so like when we think about competition, there's like the, on the demand side, sure, you know, there's the part where you're able, where, you know, new products will enter and then you're able to compete away those profits. But on the supply side of companies, we're now like, if you were to really think about the kinds of players that can then come in and compete away those profits, one, a lot of the mid-sized guys are gone, right? So they've been acquired. What remains are a number of, sure, a bunch of different game studios, but not the best ones have been acquired. And then if the recession, we'll talk about more about the recession, if the recession leads to a little bit of a dry spell or less funding of startups, then, you know, we may see less insurgents coming in to compete, to try to compete away those profits. And now I'm not drawing any specific conclusions, but I'm just saying like the picture based upon a lot of the things that are happening at the macro level is kind of interesting to think about and could, you know, kind of heavily impact our industry and the competitive dynamics of the industry. I don't know. Did that make sense, Brad?
Yeah. Most of it made sense.
Yeah. And then maybe the second point I wanted to make, and sorry, just kind of talking stream of consciousness here, but like, let's talk about it when we talk about the global recession, but I do think like I do think the traditional thinking is that games are recession proof. I think there's more nuance to that. We can jump into it, but I do think that not all of free-to-play gaming will, in my opinion, be improved based upon a recession. I think it may be more situational, but we can jump into that when we get to talking about global recession. And you had another point you wanted to talk about, Brett?
Oh, just that I think the beauty of gaming is that we have tons of companies in gaming. We have a very large prize to the winner and low risk and high iteration. So it's just a really wonderful environment for innovation. And I think that we'll have smaller gaming companies that don't want to compete like on user acquisition or traditional user acquisition, find other channels. So I think that will inevitably happen. I'm surprised it hasn't happened more yet. And so, you know, I'm kind of expecting that to happen once these UA markets dry up.
Yeah. I mean, I do think, to your point about like the dynamics of the market, the App Store is characterized by parallel distribution in terms of revenue, right? So the other thing that's really exciting about our current time is that for some of these new startup insurgents, you can very easily get from nothing to massive scale very quickly. And so, you know, even looking at a company like Dream Games with Royal Match, where they're able to just, you know, become a huge player overnight. I mean, I think that's one of the exciting things about our industry is that the ability to get to scale very, very quickly, given the size of the platforms that we're operating on.
Yeah. I mean, I've joked with you a little bit that I want to start a game myself. And I think if I did, my first question to answer would be how to get users. In fact, that's like the only thing that's not the only thing, but that's a major thing that's kind of holding me back from even exploring that more.
Okay. All right. Hot topic number two, product validation. And what is meant by product validation is basically ahead of launch. So before you launch your game, and now a lot of even mobile free-to-play game studios are working on games with development cycles that are 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, or even longer, how do you know that what you are working on for all of these years, your whole team that has invested so much time, effort, energy, sacrifice, how do you know that what you're working on will ultimately be successful or not? And very recently, and I'm not going to call out the specific company or game because I like a lot of people who have worked on some of these games, but a few games have launched recently that have been development for years to pretty big disappointment. And the big question here is, you know, was there any way to have known, to have been able to see something course corrected ahead of launch, whether it's a game design decision, whether it's something with the team or capability. And so kind of like that seems to be a pretty big question, especially with, you know, some high profile launches in the past where the question there is, could we have known earlier? You have any thoughts on this, Brett?
Well, I think if you're going to make that large of an investment, which obviously as a company you want to stay away from, right? The larger, bigger bets with more unknowns are just riskier bets. And if obviously you have to counter that with huge upsides. So that's what we do in gaming. But you know, sort of the standard is you want to figure out ways to find out information earlier on it and somehow do ghetto tests, things like that. But I would say if you are going to make those bets, then you want to be leaning in, I think, on your strategic advantages. And that's really MBA. I know, JK, you're loving that answer. I don't have an MBA. I have half one. But, you know, it's if like you have some type of thing that you know you're the best at or you have more knowledge of than all other gaming companies or most other gaming companies, right? Now, the IP is a good example, or a certain genre that you're already in is another example, or you have a certain amount of users, or you have a platform to feed those users. Like that is a bet, or that is an information advantage that I think you can make those larger bets in. Or I would say, you know, take the Bezos approach, which is like bet on things that are guarantees, which, you know, in Bezos' case is cheaper and faster service, right? And maybe you're attacking a market where it's fairly obvious what players want. They want more content or faster game or something like that. It's a little like harder in gaming, I think, because price isn't as much of a thing in gaming, and most games are fairly fast. But I think if you're going to make those bets, you just have to be feeling confident about your sort of like strategic advantage on something, because the market changes so quickly that if you have an idea 2 years ago, the value of an idea decreases over time. Yeah. So the longer it takes for you to get that idea out into the world, the less valuable it is, period. And so you just really want to work on ways to not have 2 to 3 years, you know, take 2 to 3 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is, to some degree, this is like the ultimate question in game development. How do you know? And I think this is such a hard problem. I would even argue that even if you tried to take the suggestion that you're recommending, like just try to do something better, faster, cheaper, by the time you're out, to your point, things change so fast. Like, are you going to be able to deliver a better product that is better, faster, cheaper in time before the market shifts?
Well, let me add to that. I mean, the console world has done this for years, right? I mean, so it's not like it's the blueprint's not out there. You launch a game, you crank the marketing massively, and you're basically going to break even at a minimum, right? And hope that it's going to go big. But in console, you have some competitive advantage, right? You have like a platform, you have minimum games and things like that, or you have the IP or something like that, right? So they kind of lean on that kind of stuff. They've done a ton of market research, and they're like, hey, we're going to blast the market, and at the very least, we're going to make like break even. I mean, obviously they're going to hopefully make a lot more.
I think the big mistake that a lot of executives at some of the bigger game companies make is that they oftentimes think, well, there's no way you can predict if a game is going to be successful or not, which I personally think is bullshit. But like, you know, so then they'll say, well, we're going to bet on a team who's been successful. But the mistake they often make is they're like, okay, let's look at Bill or Sally, who's working on this big successful game. And so they'll take somebody who's live operating a game, but may not have been responsible for the initial game development, the initial like development, the 0 to 1 side, the 1 to 1 to N. And then they'll say, hey, Bill and Sally, we're going to entrust you to make our next big game because you worked on this other big game. But then they don't realize there's a big difference between live ops execution versus new game development. But I would also say that when it comes to product validation, in my mind, there are like 3 specific approaches. You know, just kind of thinking of it from a PM high level perspective, that I can tell you kind of what my philosophy is on this, or the way I think about it is, and maybe you can give me some feedback on it, Brett. But it feels like there are 3 primary approaches to trying to understand product validation for a game. In the first 2 is part of like this pyramid framework that I have, that I think are best characterized by Blizzard and Riot. So starting with the top of the pyramid, and we can call it the top of pyramid or Blizzard approach. I think in this fundamental approach, the game design team or the game team believes that they are the tastemakers. They are the influencers, that if I make a game that I think is going to be fun, and oftentimes, you know, this kind of approach often focuses on mechanics, then they believe, then we will have a game that everyone finds fun. But we base this upon our own internal or personal validation as this tastemaker influencer type of person. So that's the top of the pyramid approach. And in my humble opinion, is best characterized, or an archetypal example is Blizzard. And then the bottom of the pyramid is, I think, best characterized by a company like Riot, where Riot, they even say it in their mission statement, they're focused on players, right? They're all about the players. And they think that the players dictate what makes a great game. So they often orient around, how do we get player feedback? Let's show something, demonstrate something, have something playable by the players, and let's get feedback, and then we'll iterate based upon what the players say, right? And the third approach is more of a, what I would call more of a mobile free-to-play approach. And in this approach, it's more about, let's look at the market. Let's see what games are successful and try to look at specific aspects of the game, whether it's features or things like that. And where you see some level of product market fit, maybe on one platform, you try to take it to another platform, or you kind of see the specific trends or things that are gaining traction in the market and then like pull these things together into a new product. And I don't know of a whole lot of people that do that approach, but I would say that at our company and, you know, my co-founder, Paul Layden, that's basically the approach that he follows in terms of like trying to understand, okay, for this game, the specific design that we have taken, this will work or this will not work. What do you think, Brett?
I think those are three great representations of how you may design a game. I will say, I will add at least my own experience in gaming and in being an entrepreneur is I think that whichever one you take on that, I think that going into it, realizing that your ideas are more often wrong than right, it's a good way to improve your likelihood to make a hit and to succeed. You know, I often tell people it's like if you've been a product manager in gaming, that you understand the best product managers are sort of like baseball players, where the best of the best are probably hitting at 33%. But as humans, we often are more confident in our abilities than we actually are good at something. And so, you know, often people think their ideas are 90%, 80%, 100%, like they have so much conviction around it. And I think you have to have that conviction around it, but you have to go into it with that idea that you could be Mike Trout and still be hitting at 34%. So if that's the case, you're Mike Trout and Mike Trout hits at 34%, then how do you build in systems or get input from other people, whether it be the players or whether it be other game designers or whether it be other games itself, that basically tell you that, you know, these three of four ideas or these two of four ideas are strikeouts, right? And these are two are hits, because that's, I think, how you get to a great innovative game is kind of having this balance between, man, I have conviction around these four ideas.
Yeah.
Two of them are right. Right. And I think this is a shout out to Pincus, but Pincus was kind of really good at that, being like, listen, I have a lot of conviction around these 10 ideas. One of them is right. And it's going to make us a lot of money. It's your job to go figure out which one that is. It's my job to think of the 10 ideas. So go figure out a way to convince me that we're going to go bet on three of them. And one of them is going to hit, right? Yeah. And I think that's a good way of like balancing those two concepts.
Yeah, I personally think that any of those approaches can work, and I think they've been shown to work. But I think the situational context and the nuance there is that if you are more top of pyramid, I believe that that type of approach is better for higher innovation, where you're going to see more innovative approaches being taken and integrated into a game versus bottom of pyramid, which is more around building a better incremental experience, right? The players are going to tell you what they know. They don't know what they don't know. And so at the top of the pyramid, as a tastemaker, you might be able to imagine something that is, I would say, so top of pyramid, you have a higher chance of finding a global maxima in terms of experience relative to bottom of pyramid, where you're going to take an existing proven mechanic, most likely, and make it a really great experience. And then I think the third aspect in terms of looking at different things that are working in market, I think that that would probably speak to your ability to make a contemporary game. So more around like, not even like mechanics, but even just like an experience or being able to satisfy like what's current in the market. But anyway, that's just kind of like the way that I think about it.
So my counter to this, because I always got to throw in the devil's advocate comment, is it goes back to what I was saying before, right? Like humans think they're more better at things than they really are, right? And this is my perfect example. You're a parent, I'm a parent. There's just like, and I've said this probably on the podcast before, is there's this great phenomenon where like a couple has their first baby and they're like, we're going to name them something totally unique and, you know, unique to us. And we're going to think of something great. And they sit in a room and then they think of a name and it's like Bennett or whatever. Right. And then nobody's in at that moment. No one in kindergarten is named Bennett. Right. And then their little kid Bennett shows up in kindergarten and there's three Bennetts in the class.
Yeah.
And they're like, wait a minute. I thought we were this like original thought, you know, number one approach to the system. Right. Yep. And what they didn't realize is that their unique thoughts are actually heavily influenced by the same inputs that millions of other people are getting. Right. And millions of other people are applying this same sort of creative process and coming up with the name Bennett. And names are really interesting because there's a lot of data around names. And so what we did, my wife and I, for example, we thought of those names, but then we went on these websites and they have websites to tell you how names are trending. And you can actually see like names like Bennett trending up and you can see these curves going up so that you kind of don't want to name your kid Bennett because you can kind of see that by the time Bennett lands in kindergarten. So I'm not saying that we're like some, but I'm saying that using different approaches and applying them to things. And that's why I'm saying there's like this weird dichotomy. Jocko's one of Jocko's favorite words that you have to have as I think a creative or a creator is to have this conviction, have these wild ideas, right? Go off and get them, and then somehow go find a website, a data point, a user review, a study or whatever, to just make sure you're not going to show up at kindergarten and there's going to be three Bennetts, right? It's like, yeah. why are my kids surrounded by the same name kid?
Right.
Yeah.
And not to go too far off topic from your point, but I do think the other thing that your point speaks to me about is that there are things that are happening in society and in the world that we can't quite put our finger to, which is why would certain names start to trend? There's probably a reason for it, but with all the variables and the environment and what's happening in the world, we may not be able to like pin it down. And same thing happened to me when I was naming my kids as well. It's like, oh shit, this name I randomly came up with fucking trending like a motherfucker. You know, it's like, what is going on? But, you know, but I think that's the point. Like when I meant, when you look at existing games in the market and try to find pieces of it to try and pull into a new game design, that speaks to cultural relevancy and something that's contemporary, right? Where you, I don't know why this feature is working, but there's something about this that could work. Now, let me try to holistically or using some intuition figure out, you know, the DNA of things to put together into this game that are informed by some things that we know are achieving traction in the market. And I think that, you know, just because we're using that approach, I'm hoping that there's some magic to that along the lines of the phenomenon that you're talking about.
Yeah, I was thinking about this book a couple times. My last point on it is it's sort of like, sure. You remember the book or movie Sphere by Michael Crichton?
Yes.
So they find an alien ship, right? And they like, it's just this alien ship and it's like down in the bottom of the ocean or something like that. And it's all closed. Like there's no opening to it. Okay. Yeah. And I don't want to ruin the whole book. It's a story. It's a great one. I don't think anyone's going to read it. But basically they're like, okay, let's get a scientist, a mathematician, a psychologist, a artist, like basically they just get like a military guy. Like they get just a group of different skill set people to go down and like figure out how to get into it, what's going on. And I mean, obviously it's a story of fiction, but I feel like that's kind of the process that you have to take to figure these things out is you sort of have to go through like the creative process. You have to go through the analytical process, the data-driven process, the strategic process. Like you have to kind of go through all of these to kind of figure it out. And I mean, of course you can always get lucky, right? I mean, and there's winner's bias all over the place, right? I live in, you know, if you live in any area, you can see it all over the place. This is like somebody won, right? Entrepreneurship is very much like that, right? It's like, oh my God, this person made this company this way. I should do it that way. Well, it's like, you don't really know the 990 nine people that did the same exact thing and died, you know, died, but their company died. Right. So yeah, I think that's probably a good analogy for how the best system to take.
Okay. Hot topic number three, impact of recession. And I know there's been a lot of talk about this. You know, are we headed into a recession? If so, what are the implications to gaming companies? Things like impact to funding, recruiting, should companies think about preemptive layoffs, other impacts, things like that? I think from a Web3 perspective, we're already starting to see like some Web3 game companies being challenged by the current, well, just by the fall in crypto more recently. But also, if you think about impact of recession, well, why don't I turn it over to you, Brett? You want to start in terms of when you think about a potential recession coming, what would you advise gaming studio folks to think about, or what would you see are the primary implications of a global recession?
Well, like I said earlier, I think for gaming, it can be a positive, weirdly, just because I think gaming is the highest ROI for entertainment, right? I mean, you can play for free. You can play these games for free.
Okay, can I add my nuance there, Brett? So
yeah, sure.
The nuance I would add is that I agree with you, like games are by far the lowest form of entertainment. But I think when the way that I would think about it though is premium and free to play. And then on the premium side, yeah, you know, you buy a $60 game, you get potentially hundreds of hours of entertainment, or even some free to play games, you know, you could get thousands of hours of entertainment for a very low cost. I think where there may be some difference though on the free to play side is that, at least anecdotally, I'm hearing a lot of folks talk about how whale spending has been reducing. Now, that could be because of IDFA deprecation, but I think it's also because, and this is something that the NYU professor Aswath Damodaran speaks about, is how do you think about spending in a recession or under COVID and things like that? Is like, if you were to think about two buckets, discretionary and non-discretionary spending, right? And non-discretionary means things like groceries, your rent, things like that. If you think about this as a fixed bucket, you've got your non-discretionary, which you must buy, and your discretionary spend, then in a recession, you have to think that your available discretionary spend, especially against like whale behavior in free-to-play IAP-based games, is going to decrease. And I think that's part of what we're starting to see, is that whale spending is starting to come down. So, I'll let you continue, Brett, but just wanted to add that.
I'm glad you asked me to go first, but then cut me off within like 10 seconds. Sorry. Zinger! Oh, dude. Oh, sorry. I had to throw a zinger out there. And you kind of froze okay. Mid-laugh, which was great, but that was, I had to throw a little zinger. You know I love you. That sounds like how I host my podcast. I'd love to hear what you think. Actually, I'd love to hear my own voice stink.
You were saying, Brett.
Okay, yeah, I have no idea what I was saying. I think that applies way too much logic to human beings. I mean, I just, you know, when I hear the word professor and like this makes logical sense, I mean, those people aren't gamers, right? Like go to middle America and their spending habits aren't logical. They have an ATV, a huge truck and a boat and a trailer and an RV. And their house is, you know, worth less than all that, which is fine. I'm not saying that's just a different approach than what generally the coastal like values are on spending, right? Like they just value entertainment differently, right? They're going to spend, look at an NFL football game. How much does it cost to go to them? I'm like, that's ridiculously expensive, but every stadium's packed with people, right? And and they're willing to spend multiple thousands of dollars on entertainment and not put it wherever else they're going to put it. Anyways, so why I think that it's going to still, when people go into recession, they're going to lose their jobs and they're going to look for forms of escape from their reality. And forms of escape are entertainment. And what they're going to say to themselves likely is, yeah, I could probably cut back a little bit on gaming, but what is that really going to do for me, right? $5, $10, $50 a week or whatever. And it's giving me so much escape, happiness, joy. I've got nothing else in my life right now that's really doing that for me. Therefore, I'm okay with this $5, $10, $15, $50 spend because it's not going to really put a dent in their – it's not going to change their outcome of the recession. Not to mention – if we have a recession, you're probably going to have a lot of people get on governmental, like get capital from the government. That often goes back into games as well, which is, you know, I didn't really want to say that point on the podcast, but that does happen. And so that's another one. Again, if they also, if they look at their forms of entertainment, NFL, whatever, you know, cable, blah, 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 blah. Again, in terms of ROI, games are way better. You know, you could spend $0, $2, $5, $10 and get so much more entertainment than you're going to get in cable, an NFL game or whatever. Whale spend, I don't buy that. I mean, there's definitely, when I was running a game, like there was definitely people that would be like, oh my goodness, I've spent $10,000 in Zynga Poker. Like I need to cut that. Right. And I get that, but I think that that's just natural like progression that's going to happen all the time. We're not in a recession yet. You know, I mean, the recession is probably hitting like traders and Web3 people and finance guys. That's not people that are whales, right? Like, and it's hitting tech, not whales, right? Like the recession, at least in, I'm not an expert in finance, but to my understanding, the recession hasn't hit. Like sort of like the game player base, right? Like I'm talking about like people who are, and I think the crypto thing is kind of separate. I mean, crypto, I don't really think is tied. Crypto is relative to crypto and basically the confidence people have in crypto. So I think that's kind of like completely separate from the recession that's going to come from inflation and you know, what they're doing with interest rates, right? That's really what's going to drive all this. So I think for gaming companies, well, okay, so back to the main question, and I know you're itching to jump in, JK, so I apologize.
No, take your time. Take your time.
That was just
hey, my whole day is free.
That's a slight dig. Back to the main question. Listen, if you're a game studio, what should you do? You should, as a game studio, as a business owner, you should always be paranoid about having revenues reduce, right? Like you should just always be under that paranoia. I don't care if the recession is coming next week or like 10 years from now or 2 years now, right? Like you should always be like generally, what is it like the paranoid survive and generally thinking in those terms. I think one thing you could do is get more to protect yourself, get more to contract labor. That's a good way of hedging and a good thing for large business, particularly public companies. So you don't have to say that you're laying off people, which can be bad for your stock. So I think going to the more contract labor workforce is a good way of hedging. Like obviously, we've talked about this. Liquid Grid does that a lot. We're not a public company, but it's a good way to kind of hedge. There are other things about that. Otherwise, though, I personally would also be looking at the recession as an opportunity for gaming companies to take advantage because of what I talked about before with UA, salaries, talent, capital. I mean, VCs are going to have capital. They've already raised the capital. They have to put it to work. They're not giving it back to their LPs. Okay. That's the last thing they're going to, oh, it's a recession. Okay. Here I raise. No, they're going to drop it into some recession-proof industries. Recession-proof industries are medicine, entertainment, drugs and alcohol, gambling. I mean, there's not a ton, right? Like, and then what you're saying, like basically, unsexy markets, right? Like food and some of those things are like necessities, but they're just not sexy to VCs. So of the sexy markets, there's not a ton. Gaming will be one of them. And so again, I think it's like, be prepared for the worst, but also have your eyes open for huge opportunities.
Grocery outlets up like 4x this year. Yeah, it's like the ultimate inflation hedge.
Yeah, totally. But, like groceries and like all those tech, like food related stuff, I guess. But I mean, are you going to order your food through an app now that, you know, if the recession hits? Like, I don't think so. You're probably going to drive down there. You don't have a job. Like, go down to the grocery store, you know?
Yeah. So from my perspective, I think one thing to think about, maybe further down, it may not have hit many gaming companies yet, but if we look at tech, tech's already in, I think, because tech, I think they try to be a little bit more forward-looking than other companies that are more reactive in nature, but we're seeing a lot of layoffs being announced here in Silicon Valley. I can't speak to other parts of the world, but I do think that in gaming, this will be delayed, but I do see layoffs coming, especially if we are thinking about a prolonged recessionary environment. I don't see how some companies that are already challenged because of UA and of other things that we're talking about would be able to keep everybody, in my opinion. I think in terms of funding.
See, I think that would be just to jump in, because I was going to do another joke on this, but I think that's more of an opportunity the company is just doing and taking advantage. I think if they do that, they're just taking advantage of recession as the storyline, and they've been, you know, like their profit margins have been declining, right? And they're kind of like throwing this in that bucket, so they don't have to say like, you know, our profits have been dropping for 3 years now. UA has been declining, and we're in a recession. I personally think that's just going to be like PR.
I think it's for probably gaming a little companies. Bit of both.
Tech companies is different. Like tech companies, no. I think
even for tech companies, I think you're right. I think that there are a number of tech companies who probably wanted to do a layoff, but it's like, you know, they're pussies, so they're like, well, we're not going to fire these guys. And now the recession comes. But I, for me, though, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that we're looking at, you know, not only a recession, but a potential inflationary period. And to some degree, I think inflation is the bigger risk relative to a recession, because for folks who are thinking about longer term game projects, right, then it's hard to be able to model, and you're going to need a larger amount of capital in order to invest in game projects under an uncertain inflationary environment. So I don't know.
The VCs are going to have the same inflationary impact, right? So they're going to. I mean, I thought you were going to say that inflation, it's going to be harder for gaming companies to change prices as inflation happens or something, but I don't see that with the inflation. I think, again, VCs are going to have their money, and they're going to be giving it to gaming companies, right? Web3 or just mobile gaming or console gaming. Like, it's going to remain an attractive market if we hit it. Now, I think there's obviously always caveats. Yeah. There's two types of recessions. There's one that's going to be like the ones we've had in the last 20 years, right? Since we've been alive a lot longer, but like, you know, working or whatever, where you basically have a tough time, right? And then there's like depressionary recession, where like people are like, it's like extreme recession. So I guess it's a depression, but like, it just kind of just depends on how close you get to that, right? Like if you think about the recessions we've had in the past, like at least for, you know, the bubbles, I don't know what I'm trying to say here. It's just like, I guess it just depends on how severe these recessions are, right? Like if you do start getting to the point where we had in like the 30s or 20, you know, late 20s, like that's depression, I guess, area, but that would definitely impact everybody. Then you're just talking about like but again, I think gaming in relative to the impact on everyone else is going to be less. People are just going to have the means to spend $5 or $2 or whatever they need to spend to.
Yeah, gaming is less impacted for sure. I agree with that. But do we agree that layoffs are likely coming on a greater at least to a greater degree than before.
I mean, for gaming, I think if they are, they're just like you said, because companies don't like to get rid of people, and this is a really good excuse to do it. You know, they're just kind of using that as an excuse. I mean, they should have probably been getting rid of these people for the last 2 years, and they're just like, oh, this is like a good time to, you know, clean up. We've hired a person. You know, I mean, it's just like you get to these companies. I mean, you like, I'll play you in this podcast where you just get to like crap on a random fiction. But it's like you get to these companies and it's like the last company was at is like, oh, talk to the product marketing, you know, text person who is in charge of writing headers before you do that. Okay, you talk to that like one person who's in charge of the header. And then make sure you talk to the marketing director, header, who's in charge of the text. And you talk like there's a person for every little thing in the company. And you just, and then a recession comes and you're like, do we really need like five people to write like a blog post? It's like, no, it's a blog post. Like, get rid of four of them. You know what I mean? So yeah, that might happen, but I don't think it's going to be driven, at least in gaming, I don't think it's going to be driven by the recession. I think in tech for sure.
Yeah. So I think we both agree on that part. I think the part we disagree upon and probably related to that view is our views on free-to-play spend. So I personally believe there is going to be a decrease. Now, the extent of the decrease, I don't know, but, you know, just discretionary spend, I just don't see it staying the same. It's going to reduce potentially dramatically with a recession and with inflation. So in which case I see, you know, kind of free-to-play spend decrease, which would then decrease the margins, and because also because of IDFA deprecation and the ability, the fall of UA, I just think that some companies are not going to be as viable as they were before. And so focus on cost structure, reducing costs, some companies going out of business, things like that. I think that will also lead to increased layoffs, I think. But that seems to be like the main area where we disagree, probably tied to the free-to-play spend.
Yeah. Yeah, and the last thing I will say, I mean, you led with like preemptive. I don't like the idea of preemptive layoff. I think for gaming, and I'm just focused on gaming. I just think that's it's not something I would do. I mean, if you, I would prepare for, I would always be prepared for revenue declining, right? Whether it be because of recession, because of UA, because of your game didn't hit, whatever, right? Like those, there's just like revenue may decline at any moment for lots of different reasons. Recession could be one of them. My guess is it's not. JK's guess is it is. So it's like, okay, but there could be something else. So preemptive, no. Preemptive, prepared to lay people off? Yes. Right? Like that should always be something that you're concerned about. But I wouldn't preemptively, because like I said, it could be a huge opportunity for gaming. This could be like a huge win. So like you don't want to lay those people off and then be short stacked. I mean COVID was a good example. It's like if COVID hit and you were like, let's preemptively lay off 10%, 20%, just prepare for whatever's gonna happen with COVID, you may have fallen massively behind because other companies did really well during COVID, right? So it's kind of a good example of why I wouldn't preemptively do something like that.
Okay. The other impacts of recession could also impact game monetization. And this is something I also got from Aswath Damodaran, but he mentioned that during a recession, people tend to not cancel subscriptions versus like upgrading. So they're less likely to upgrade subscription, but also less likely to like upgrade or something like that, or make a new purchase. So I think from a free-to-play monetization perspective, if that's true, then you could interpret that to mean that during under recession, things like Battle Pass may see increased concentration of revenue versus like a new spend or like a sales bundle of some kind. So we may see a shift in terms of the types of IP spend that players will buy during a recession or not, but I believe that will happen. And maybe the last thing to talk about is, and you brought this up before, Brett, is cost structure. that under recession, I think that we're going to see organizations, and the longer we're under a recession, I think the more that this occurs, is increasingly shifting towards a lower cost structure types of organizations. So we kind of saw this before. And if you look at the public financial disclosures of many gaming companies, you saw increasingly over time, like Zynga, EA, would start to shift their development offshore. And I would think that under prolonged recession, we'll see an increasing shift of these organizations towards more offshore, to India, to China, to countries like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say that you should focus on, I mean, you should always do this, but you should, I think recession will help you take a critical eye on things. It's just higher ROI processes, right? And I think we gravitate towards it being lower costs, because I think that it's just kind of like, I don't know why. I mean, it's sort of an obvious potential solution. But I think there's lots of solutions to the problem. And Valve is a good example of going the complete opposite direction and saying, we're not going to go lower costs, we're going to go better people, and we're actually going to pay them a lot more than the market, because we believe that we're getting 5x the value from the best developer, and therefore the gap between their cost and the value you get from them is much larger than getting the low cost developer and having to hire like 10 of them. And so yep. I think I just like want to add to that. I want to say like, oh, recession, go low cost, because or like reduce your employee cost. That's not, at least to my mind, it's a little nuanced, but that's not really what I would think it. I would think like, how do I get more value gap between my cost and my revenue, right? Like that's more, or my, you know, that's more important. So maybe like my example was like, maybe there's one person who could do all five jobs, and the reason they're not is because your systems suck. And that was kind of the example that I experienced when I was at the last company, which was like, I could probably do most of this, but we've hired five people, and those five people have to fucking they have to legitimize their job. So they're going to like, you know, fucking own the header and then own the subheader and then own the text and all, everything else, you know?
Yeah, I think to your point, I think it's true that I think it's situational, right? It depends on the kind of product that you have. If you have an incredible product that scales, then it's kind of like you're operating a Facebook or a Google, right? Like they hire people to just sit on the bench for, you know, $300,000, $500,000 a year, just so that they don't go out and compete against them. You know what I'm saying? Like, so it depends on the situation you're in. But I think the general view of taking, especially like from a live ops perspective, of taking like, you know, more turn the crank top types of opportunity, and reducing costs, if it's not like a super scaled type of product, like a Facebook or Google, I can see that happening. It won't happen for every game studio, but I can see it happening for a number of game studios.
Yeah. Well, it will. And what I'm saying is it will, because to jump on your bandwagon, I mean, there's a lot of shitty managers out there, right? So they're just going to like go to the most obvious answer, which is let's outsource to India, like, you know. And they're for some companies that will work, right? And some, you know, or wherever it is, like, you know, I'm not saying that's like, you know, just an obvious. I know you guys are doing that. I'm not like shitting out. I'm just saying, like, I feel like there's reducing cost is one way of solving the problem. It's not the only way, right? And I think it's like the easiest. It's sort of the easiest thing for management. So
yeah, and ultimately, like when you think about engineers, for example, like there are. I mean, Steve Jobs characterized Woz as a 30x engineer. Like what Woz could do, you'd have to get 30 other people to compare to his productivity and output. And so, like, if you were to find a Woz and pay him 5x, then you've got a dramatic cost saving. So it also depends on people. It's all very situational in the end.
Yeah. And it's just like looking for value gaps is kind of the point, right? With the assumption that, I guess it's just, I should always be doing that, I guess. But I guess there's like extreme potential extreme drop in revenue. What would I do? Yeah. You should email all the people that were going to acquire you a month ago and tell them that you want to get acquired now.
All right. Hot topic number four, politics in the company.
What do you think about? We're almost about to an hour. What do you think about? I think that that topic is like maybe something we don't want to hit on an hour into our talk. We're like pretty loose and that one's like a little bit sketchy. I think we should cut it. It's Saturday. It's an hour. All right, we're like three. Nobody. We can save it for next week. I'm thinking that that's probably one that we want to flush out a little bit, man. Right.
We'll punt on that. But I think it got low, if you look at
the ranking of your survey to adopt your second approach to game development or podcast development. Do politics belong in companies? Only got 6%. So we hit the three big ones. We hit 93% of all of the people that wanted to talk about. So I don't think we need to go into let's trust the player. Let's trust the users and say that's not and is not interesting and it's potentially going to get us in trouble.
So maybe just to speak on some of the other hot topics that kind of came up or that I've been hearing from folks. One is around employee compensation, meaning have we gone too far? And I know of some game studios who are paying like fresh graduates. This is someone just out of college, like $150,000 to over $200,000. You know, it's just like, what is going on? And then, you know, and then they're like Gen Zers, you know, it's just like, hey, do I get to work from home? And like, what are my hours going to be like? It's just like, oh my God.
See, this is why I'm glad we're not doing the other topic. We're loose. We're loose. As you go later in these podcasts, it gets looser and looser, you know? So it's like, we're just like making fun of generations of people. I'll counter that. I have a lot of really strong young workers, and you're right, though. They will be. I'll be like, you want to work? How often you want to work? They're like, I ideally like to work 3 out of 4 weeks. I'm like, well, okay. Like our structure just set up for it.
Yeah.
But of those 3 weeks, they're amazing. You know, they're like really good workers. Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, obviously counter examples of that. But yeah, you'll be like, do you want to work, you know, more? And they're like, nah. You want to like move up? Nah. You know, okay. Well, you're good. Yeah,
I guess the question is, has comp gotten out of hand though, just because of all the crazy funding in the current, you know, macroeconomic environment, you know, and how the Fed just flooded the system with cash and zero interest rates and everyone's comp has gone crazy and things like that. This is one of the reasons why I actually think a global recession is good for us, right? No. Like, can we reset?
No, I'm saying that's good. No, I'm saying that's good. Like if your competitors are all spending like $300,000 on a new grad they know nothing about, like, good, you know, to, again, I'm just quoting Jocko. It's like, great. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I'll find somebody from India, like you guys have, who costs a fraction of that. And I'll get the same output from them and I'll be building a similar game. So, I mean, if that's the case, good. You know what I mean? Like if you've let your HR department just go crazy and compete and just be like, you know, I mean, because that's what happens. It's like individuals and organizations not aligned with the actual goals of the company, right? They're aligned with their individual goals, which is likely to be beat out Facebook. We can't lose this person to Facebook. Like, why not? You know, like, you know, why are you competing with Facebook? Facebook is Facebook. Like, figure out a different way to get that person and don't compete on salary, right? Like, right? So good. I mean, that's great. I hope everybody, just like when everyone's going back to work, I'm like, good. You guys should all go back to the office. You guys should all drive and commute and fucking have one-on-ones and happy hours. Spend all your money on happy hours and parties and espressos and whatever else the fuck you guys spend your money on. Good. I'm sitting here with like a super efficient company that doesn't spend any money on any of that shit. What was the other one? I'm some finance guy. We all flew to Portugal for an offsite. Good. Good. That's good. I like that. You should spend more money on your offsites where you flew across the world for, I don't know, to have a conversation with someone you could have over Zoom, you know, like, I don't know. That's my loosey goosey rant. That's why we have to end this soon. It's like, let people do stupid shit, JK. Just let them. That's awesome for us. If you're out, if you're smarter than them, and that's kind of why I started my company. It's like, if you think you're so smart, if you think you're so smart, JK, right? If everybody's doing this terrible thing, then great. Then take advantage of that. You want people to be stupid in a way, right? Mm-hmm. Because that makes more. If everyone's super awesome on salary, you're not going to be able to get people.
Yeah. And by the way, I bring up the issue not so much in terms of, hey, I want to make a value judgment on this, but more around, you know, where do we think it's headed and what are the potential implications for this, right? And so, I mean, I think that part of the implications is that a lot of the employee comp that's kind of gone too far really speaks to some of the higher wage areas. So like Silicon Valley, New York, places like that. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think that in the current situation, remote work as well as offshore work, workers or organizations benefit. But I also think that with a global recession, I think the thing that is a problem for businesses isn't so much, hey, you know, we're spending X amount of money on new grads, but what does our expenses look like in the future? Can we predict what our costs are going to be, or are we going to have to increase comp by 30%, 50% every year? You know, like, what does that look like? How can we plan in an era of so much uncertainty where comp just continues to drive upwards in a non-predictable way? So, you know, that's probably more of why I bring up employee comp rather than, hey, I think these, you know, fuck these, you know, these fresh grads making too much. Dude, I don't care what they make, you know, I all the more power to them. To your point, I fully accept, you know, whatever the market does, what the market does, and that's great. But then how do we operate the most effectively under the current market environment? And then how do we think about where the market's going so that we can best prepare for it? I think that's my point. But yeah, I mean, go ahead.
I mean, I've probably said this before, but I think it's probably the most important thing I've learned in the last couple of years is that you generate the greatest value for yourself in business and generally in life, I think, if you push yourself to find a creative solution to a problem that everyone else is having, right, or that you have, right? Or that is a common problem, okay? And I think that's what really is important for leaders to do. It's critical for people to do that in entrepreneurial roles. It's more, a little bit more difficult when you're in a larger business. So I apologize if you don't have like the control to do it, you know, but you can do it in your own life. It's like humans will often just that first solution, right? I mean, it's just like, there's an obvious one. Okay. And pushing yourself, spending more time, meditate, write out research, talk to experts, blah, blah, blah. Push yourself to be like, okay, here is how everyone's solving this with like sort of their just initial, like not uneducated, but like less vetted way. How can I push myself to find a solution that's different and that can give me an advantage over other people? And I think this is a perfect example. It's like, okay, people are paying people too much, apparently. Great. How can I figure out a way that I can pay people a lot less, but give them something else, for example, right? Yeah. I could give them more equity. I could give them more autonomy. I could give them the ability to work wherever they want. I could give them way better medical benefits. I could, you know, it's just, it's like, get creative. You don't always have to just get creative in your game design, right? Like you can get much very creative in your company design and in your in what you do. So
I totally agree with you, Brett. I think that that aspect is a good part of employee compensation going higher, is that you need to then think about how do you compete on a non-comp based level. And I think the other thing that I would just warn founders is that, you know, you can kind of say, well, okay, great, employee compensation, I'm not going to think about it, I don't need to worry about it. But by default, as a founder or executive at a company, you must have a perspective on employee compensation. Because if you're doing any form of long-term planning and you don't have a view on where it's going, it's automatically reflected for you in whatever your P&L assumptions are. So if you've raised too little and employee comp goes up, well, guess what? You're fucked. And so I just think that, to your point, more people need to think about this in the context of not only how do we compete and how do we get people and retain people in an era of high employee compensation and a highly competitive employee market, but also based on planning and whether you have planned appropriately and designed a team in a way such that you're able to complete your projects under budget.
It's tough. Okay. Man.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll bring up the last thing. And this is actually a topic.
I think this is probably as much as I can go. Yeah. Just because I gotta go take care of the kid. My wife's gone this weekend. So, kiddos are downstairs. I think we should save it. We've got an hour. I'm also not like, I don't have the stamina that I used to. I got to build it up a little bit. We're an hour and 10 in. Who's going to listen beyond an hour and 10 minutes, JK? Like,
you'd 10, be surprised.
10 people.
All right. Well, okay. No, we'll call it right here. There you have it.
We got this for next week. We got it for next week, dude. I'm around. Let's just do another one. You know, we don't have to get them all in. All right. Yeah. I think this was fun.
Okay.
That's all right with you, man.
All good. All right, guys, until next time, philosophy, hot topics. Catch you later.